Yeah, I put it in the wrong place.
Good evening. I want to welcome everybody. And of course, on behalf of Merkaz and Rabbi Hittery and the whole committee, we want to thank Richie and Razi for hosting us this evening. And we want to thank the rabbi for coming all the way from Deal. I just want to mention quickly a few upcoming events we have. Check your emails for the details. But save the date. Saturday night, December 3rd, that's a week from this coming Saturday, we're going to have Rabbi Moshe Halbatal, who's going to speak on Tzedakah. It's probably going to be in Sephardic, right? And we'll have a light dinner. And on December 26th, everyone should be off from work. What? Oh, didn't I say Tzedakah? How much do you have to give? That's a
charity.
Rabbi. And December 26th, the adults will be off, and the children will be in school, so it's a great day to spend a few hours learning, and we're going to have a morning program with Minyan and breakfast and a couple of lecturers to be announced. And Rabbi Hiri will let you know about that by email. And we also have a Shabbaton coming up in February 25th with Professor Lauren Schiffman, who is an expert on Second Temple history, specifically the Dead Sea Scrolls. And
Jesus.
And the topic's going to be Judaism in relation to Christianity and Islam, and we're going to also probably have Professor Svigor, who's an expert on Islam, to speak on that topic. And I give you our favorite rabbi.
Thank you. Okay, tonight's class is Lilui Nishmat of Mazal Bat Roza, and a few words about her would be appropriate. Certainly an extraordinary woman, certainly a woman who lit up the world in which she lived. Those of us who were fortunate enough to know her, even under the most difficult of circumstances, such as hospital surgery, she was able to bring great cheer and great joy. And it's not exaggerated to say how much we laughed that Shabbat that we were in the hospital together, having done the same surgery with the same surgeon. And it'll be an experience that I'll never forget. And she was such an extraordinary person that I could say that she added a lot to life. Not only in terms of getting through the surgery and the aftermath of that, just her presence, and it was always a joy to visit her, and just a wonderful, wonderful person. As well, our class tonight is Lulu Shmat Ezra Hayim Ben Shoshana. And also, it's appropriate to say a few words about Eddie. And here's a young man who is 23 years old, stricken by cancer, who fought valiantly against it. Ironically, had it for the same 7 years that I had it. He was a student in school, and I was a teacher in school. And just an amazing person who was able to make that experience to be a very positive one. As horrifying as it was with the chemotherapy and the surgeries and all that he had to go through, he was able to live life with a great deal of dignity and energy and dynamism, and he always was a source of encouragement to me specifically. I now, of course, as most of you know, run 4.5 miles every night. And it's because of him that I run 4.5 miles every night, because he told me that you have to work out to get through this. And I started doing that, and he's an overwhelming person. And as well, our shiur tonight is that we should hope that Vega Bat Esther should have it for Ashinema, and that she should be well, God willing. Let's begin. Hello. My name is Rabbi Ezra Labaton. Let's analyze that statement. First is a title. The title is Rabbi. Second, I have a given name, Ezra. And third, I have a last name, Labaton. The name Labaton goes back about 500, 600 years. It goes back to a small village in Spain. A village dominated by a very large castle whose proprietor at one point was named Labaton. And about 2 years ago, my daughter was teaching in Germany for the year, and she went to visit the village and the castle, and she actually wanted it back. She wanted the deed, didn't get it back. So the name Labaton is an interesting name that one could speak a lot about, but I'm more concerned about the name Ezra. Before I begin, I'd like to ask you, what is your name?
David Azar.
Dr. David Azar.
If you must.
I must.
Captain David.
One who, captain as well, who causes pain to people, drills their teeth. Okay, and?
Charges money for it.
And charges money to give them pain. Yeah. Tell us a little about your name. Do you know anything about your name? Who you named after?
Yes, King. Interesting that when my grandfather came to America, he took on the name Cohen, and the family was coming for a while, and then my father and his brothers went legally to change the name back to Azar. So the name Azar is the original name back from...
What does it mean?
It means to help, or helper.
So you spell your name as an ayin.
Yeah.
In Hebrew. So it means to help. Yeah. Do you know why they called your great-great-great-great-great-grandfather the helper? He was David the helper at a certain point. It's an interesting issue. Good. Your name, please.
Richard Matthews.
Are you related to the Apostle Matthews, one of the followers of Jesus?
I don't think so.
I hope not. Okay, tell me something about your name. How far does it go back? When was it changed?
I don't know. I know it was changed probably from Matityahu.
Matityahu, okay, good, right.
Because it was told to me that my grandfather wanted to become a lawyer.
In America?
In America, there was no such thing as a Jewish lawyer in those days.
Right.
The name was changed.
To become more... assimilated, Americanized. I have two questions to ask now. Would I have been a different person if I had a different name? Would you? Would anybody here have been a different person if they had a different name? Does your name affect your career choice? Does your name affect your personality at all? If I were named Chris, but I still have chosen to become a rabbi, imagine if I introduced myself tonight, my name is Rabbi Chris Labaton. That certainly would have been a jarring statement. How many of you think that your given names affect your career choice? Nobody. How many of you think that you're all wrong, by the way. And how many of you think that your name, your given name, affects your personality?
That's for sure.
Give me an example of that. As a teacher.
I'm not as a teacher,
okay.
As a person.
Okay. Well, tell us your name.
My name is Florence.
Good.
So to me, that's a name that as a child I always hated. It was always like...
Wow, really?
It to me was always like an old woman's name. So I figured if I had a name that was more...
Whoa.
I don't know, like a... Yeah, but a different kind of name. That maybe the person that maybe it would have been different. Maybe the name
would have made
me to behave in a certain way.
Okay, good, excellent, good.
A certain name would give me a different kind of confidence that maybe I lack.
Fantastic point. Hold on to that. Are you happy with your name? What is your name?
Sarah.
And you're happy with that name? You never thought twice about it. Would you prefer another name, say like Wendy or something?
No, I like it.
You like Sari? When I had my children, I wanted them all biblical names. And I did. So I ended up with an Ovadia. Could you imagine what it's like to be on Wall Street with a name like Ovadia? So I told him, you can choose Alfred. I understand. No, he wants Ovadia. And I don't know how, but he got a job with the name Ovadia. We were in Boston. The librarian said, I love the name Obadiah. And she actually found books about Obadiah and the pilgrims. And we made at one point, the big t-shirt says Obadiah on it. Trying to give him confidence with that name. So we succeeded to a certain degree.
I'm
sorry?
My son Ezekiel.
That's very biblical.
It's
very correct. But it also could be a badge of distinction depending upon how you played it out. That's how we should wear it. Right. My daughter actually got the name Sarah Doris. Now, as long as she was in Boston, she was Sarah. When she came to deal, she was Doris. And so that means a little bit of a split personality. So she went through high school as mainly Sarah. Then in college, she wanted to have a much more distinct personality. She started calling herself Doris exclusively.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, at Columbia, there were a lot of Sarahs, and there was no Dorises. So she wanted to be Doris Labaton as opposed to Sarah Labaton. So that was interesting, of how that worked. Now, let's say your name is Sarah or Doris. With which name do you think you're getting more dates?
Easier thing.
Sight unseen?
Yeah. In other words, if you're a guy, let's say, and somebody you call up somebody on a blind date, say, my name is Sarah, or my name is Doris. Does that make a difference, you think, at all? You think it does, Harvey? Tell me something about that.
Well, sure, but Doris is much...
Sorry?
No, we did so much. I thought twice when my name was Florence. I hesitated.
So So who do you want? Who would you rather go with, the Sarah or the Doris?
Sarah.
Sarah, you want to go? You want somebody Sarah? Absolutely correct. Okay, good, 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 good. I was interested in the notion of the psychology of names. So I checked on the internet, and there are 4,300,000 sites that name psychology of names. 4,300,000 sites that deal with the notion of the psychology of names, including an article that's entitled, ready for this, Harvey? The effect of first names on perceptions of female attractiveness. Say that again. The effect of first names on perceptions of female attractiveness. Meaning that if your first name is X or Y or Z, a male who hears it will think that you are prettier or less pretty based on your first name alone. In other words, men have perceptions that if your name is, let's say, give me the ugliest name you know.
Agnes or Gertrude.
Agnes, Gertrude, good, good.
Nazira.
Well, that
was that.
No, interesting.
I had a very hard name.
Now, you're Nizha. Two different names.
Nazira?
No, two different roots.
Oh,
when my daughter was taking Arabic at school, when my daughter was taking Arabic in school, the professor asked her, what's your name? She pressed Anna Nizha. And throughout that entire year, she would speak to everybody as her name was Nizha, which means pleasant, sweet, gentle, kind. She liked the name, Nizha. So, interesting that that article says that the name has an effect on male perception of female attractiveness. Another article also on the internet, of which you read the abstract of it. Quote, this is the name of the article. By which name shall I call thee? : the consequences of having multiple names. How many people here have multiple first names?
What do you mean, like a nickname?
No, like I'm Ezra Ronnie, or Ronnie Ezra.
Oh, okay.
She's Esther Robin, she's Sari Wendy.
Okay.
So now there are consequences to having multiple names.
Well, we never use
them. Well, the article discusses if your perception of yourself, of having two names, or one name, changes your self-perception. So there's a lot to be said about multiple names, about attractiveness, and the psychology of names. And if you have multiple names, and you want to know the consequences of having multiple names, read the article. Let's go to the Bible and raise the question about what do names mean in the Bible. Let's ask this question. What are two of the most absurd names in the entire Bible? Which two names would cause you to shake and shirk if your parents named you those two names? Yeah.
Habakkuk.
You don't like Habakkuk? You think it's absurd? It's Sam.
My father was thinking of naming me.
Really?
He was teasing my mother.
That's a good story. Who would you have been if you were not David? You would have been Habakkuk. And what would you achieve in this world?
You wouldn't have been good.
You might have not.
Especially in public school.
Yes, I don't know. They might have left you alone, a man like that. From outer space, at least. Don't touch this guy. Well, yeah?
Haman.
What's absurd about Haman?
It's a
person.
It's what? It's like an
evil. No, the name per se.
But Mephibosheth, I remember.
What's wrong with Moshe?
No, he said Mephibosheth.
Sorry?
He said Mephibosheth.
Oh,
Mephibosheth.
I want a worse name than that.
Rehazi.
No, I like Rehazi.
Ikavot.
Ikavod is interesting, which means I have no respect and no dignity. Imagine going up Ikavai or Ikavod, no respect and no dignity. No, the answer I'm looking for is Mahlon and Kiryon. Name the book of Ruth. Mahlon. What do you think the root of that name sounds like? Mahala. What does Mahala mean? Illness. Where does Kilayon come from? Sounds like, at least to the ear, Kilayon, which means destruction, devastation. So imagine calling your kids illness and devastation. What kind of life is that those kids going to have? The answer is a very bad life. Yeah?
I kind of think that those names were given in retrospect after a lifetime of experience because they died earlier. What they had premature death.
Thank you. Well, we're going to see. We're going to come back to that point. So hold on to that for a second.
The name given at birth, that's my impression.
Well, we hope not. Calling it illness and devastation. Unless they're my kids, then. Calling it. Okay, good. Very strange for a parent to call their children illness and devastation. Let's look at to see whether or not the names of the book of Ruth are going to follow a pattern. Now, is there a pattern, you think? Yes, there is a pattern. Let's look at, for example, the name Naomi. What does Naomi mean in Hebrew?
Pleasant.
Pleasant. Good. Pleasant. Like Nissa, pleasant. Is there a play on the name Naomi in the book of Ruth? Yes, she tells herself. She returns from her exile from where she had left. And everybody said, is this Naomi? Which means pleasant. And what did she say over there? Al tikrena li Naomi, don't call me Naomi. Kira li, rather, call me by another name. What name should they call her? Bitterness. Because my life has been so bitter. She lost her husband, her two sons. She left a very rich woman. She comes back poverty-stricken. No bread, no food whatsoever. So there's a pun on the name Naomi in that book.
What's the pun? Bitterness is what?
Well,
the opposite of
Naomi. Now let's look even further, right? Her name, therefore, then is ironic. Use the word ironic. Good. What's her husband's name? Elimelech. My Lord is my God. But what does he do when at a moment when crisis strikes, he leaves? Would God want him to leave? No. So, was the Lord his king? Elimelech. The Lord is my king. Was the Lord his king? Mass sovereign? Exactly the opposite. So his name as well shows a kind of irony. Good. Next. They have two daughters-in-law. What's the name of the first daughter-in-law? Orpah. Where does the word Orpah come from? Orif means neck. What does Orpah do to her mother-in-law when the going gets tough?
She walks away.
She walks away and shows her mother-in-law her back or her neck. She walks away. Doesn't go with her mother-in-law. On the other hand, Ruth stays with her mother-in-law through thick and thin. So I was always perplexed. All the names in this book seem to have an ironic or an absurd kind of connotation. Ruth I couldn't figure out. Right. Let's go a step further.
Not ironic. Orpah is an accurate.
That's my point. Okay, yes, that's my point. But the name has meaning and significance.
The other is an accidentary. This one.
Yeah, of course. That's my point. The name has a meaning and a significance. That she showed her the back of her neck, and we call her Orpah. So whoever wrote or rewrote this scroll, this Megillah, this book, decided to give the names either ironic or absurd, calling the kids destruction and illness, some kind of connotation. Let's go further. Who's the hero of the book? Boaz. What does the word Boaz mean? With strength. What did he do? He acted heroically and took in Ruth when she had nothing and decided to marry her. He acted with great moral fortitude. Strength. In the Bible, strength means moral strength. He had great moral strength. Good. Now the best name is, there was one man in this book who acted horribly. Who's that?
Peroni.
Peroni Almoni. Now Peroni Almoni means somebody who is, it means
so-and-so.
Joe Schmo. No name is given to this person. He has no name. Ironic. Why is it ironic? Because what does he do? In that society, if a woman is married and loses her husband and has no children, so that woman and that man who died has no children to call after his name, and biblically that was viewed as being terrible to have nobody named after you, so we ask that woman, please, marry somebody and call that first child after your husband passed away. Keep his name alive. Peroni Almoni, who was Mr. No Name, refused to marry Ruth and thereby should have called his first child by the husband who passed away. I don't want to do that. I don't want to marry this woman. So the man refused to give a name till the man who passed away ends up in this book with
no name.
No name. Ironic. He becomes Mr. No Name because you refuse to give a name to somebody else. So every one of these names has a significance, an irony, a meaning. So too, Root. When I looked up in a recently acquired book, Etymological Dictionary of the Old Testament, of the Bible, Root comes to the word Resh Vav He, perhaps, which means to sustain and to love. To water. To pour water on. To sustain, to water, to love. So what is the epitome of Root? Love, sustaining her mother-in-law, going with her, no matter what the consequences were. So even Ruth's name seems to have some kind of meaning, intrinsic meaning. So every name in this book has a kind of meaning. So now once I had come to the realization that all of these names have meaning to them, I decided to look in other places to find out where else does the Bible give us meaningful names itself.
Am I right? The names are not given at birth.
I agree. I think the book was rewritten at a certain point by the rabbis who had a very fine sense of humor, and they wanted to call the children who intermarried destruction and illness, and Naomi and bitterness, and the men who acted with great strength and moral fortitude, Boaz, Be'oz. If you look throughout the Bible where that name, where that, those terms appears, it's moral fortitude. So yes, you're right, absolutely right. That this book was rewritten with a notion of changing the names to make the book more literarily interesting and more, therefore, theologically interesting, because ultimately, Ruth, who shows great love to a mother, she comes from a foreign nation, a Moabite nation, she's not Jewish, and she converts, and she becomes the great-great-grandmother of King David, who is the great-great-great-great ancestor of the Messiah. The Messiah comes from a non-Jewish woman, a Moabite woman. That's a great theological principle, that Judaism is less a biology and more an ideology. Because Ruth was able to embody so perfectly well all of the values that means to be a Jew, therefore she becomes the great, great, great grandmother of David and of the Messiah. But she can't come to my shul. She's a convert. Keep her out. In the Syrian community, Mashiach's not coming. Because his great, great grandmother was a convert. Which is interesting. Okay, don't worry about that. Sorry?
Convert can't come into you.
They can walk in, but we'll ignore them.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, we once had a black guy who walked in, and we knew that he was converted. And it was interesting, because they came to me, running to me. I was main sanctuary, the first minyan he went to. He's a rabbinical student at Yeshiva University. And they came to me, we invited him for an aliyah, what should we do?
No,
one of the people there who invites. Uh-huh. So half the people in that minyan are walking out because he's a convert. And I said, what should we do? So what did I say?
Let him go up.
Do you all agree with that?
Once you invited him, now you
invited him. He's
there. Okay, good. That's what you asked. Sorry?
It's the biggest sin to embarrass him.
Right. Oh, yes, me? Yeah, I agree with that.
Wow.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's the biggest sin to embarrass him, to shame him, exactly. But don't tell anybody that I started that.
Yeah.
So I said, give him the aliyah, and that's it. And those who walked out, don't give them the aliyah. That's what I said to them. Because that, you're of course right, that it's a bigger sin. Sorry?
That's why you get all the flack.
Yeah, I guess so, but it's okay. Let's now turn to names in the book of Bereshit or Genesis. Now, it's obvious that names are significant as well in the book of Genesis, or the first book of the Bible, the book of Bereshit. The very first person is named
Adam
or Adam. Why does God call him the name Adam?
Adam.
He comes from the ground. He was fashioned from the ground. Right? And in a literal sense, as you all know, we of course are all made of molecules and atoms, and our distant origin is stardust. Because all atoms come from some star that exploded at some point in the universe, and were rained on us, and we are made, if you go back far enough, from stardust or from Adamah. Right? Yes? Clear? Okay, good. Now, is that significant? What is the name Adam, or Adama, or earth, or ground? What is it foreshadowing? What's going to happen
back
to this person whose name Adama, or Adam? What happens? Well, he's going to be in the Garden of Eden. He's going to transgress. He's going to sin. And then he's going to be thrown out of God's Eden. And what's going to happen? The ground, sorry? And what's going to happen? Where's he going to work for? Where?
In
from the Adama, exactly. So the ground is going to be cursed. Good. Because of what he did. Lo tosef tet kohah. The ground's only going to give you the strength of its produce. Before, you had God, didn't everything was there for you. All of a sudden, what's going to happen? You want food, you have to work the ground. It will only give to you. So, man, Adam, now has an interesting relationship with Adama. Where else and when else is the Adama cursed because of an action of man?
Cain.
Cain, the first brother in the Bible, had a very difficult relationship with his brother, sibling rivalry. And what happens? Cain decides to kill Hevel. God challenges him on that. How dare you kill your brother? And at the end, of course, Arur Adama Ba'urecha. The ground, Adama, is going to be cursed because of what you did, because the ground absorbed your brother's blood. He killed him. He's now slain. What happens? Now the blood flows, and the ground became bloody and absorbed his blood. Therefore, here God says, I'm going to curse the ground for absorbing your brother's blood. So again, an interesting relationship between Adama and Adam. Good. Now, furthermore, who's the first woman in the Bible? Chava. What does her name mean? Chava means from life. Am kol hai. Beautiful name. A mother is a mother of life. Although, interestingly enough, in Aramaic, that same root means snake. Why does it mean also snake? What pun is being played over here? Where did Adam, the man, who called his wife Chava, where did they have a relationship with a snake? In the Garden of Eden, where they ate the apple. Right, the snake was the perpetrator in this narrative of this entire downfall. The snake crawls around, talks to the woman, etc., in this metaphorical statement. And the woman commits to the man. So Adam, though he re-relates to his wife and calls her name, which means to grant her status and dignity. When you call somebody a name, it means you're a person, you're something special to me. But he never forgot what happened. He never forgot that she was involved with the snake, who ultimately caused me to be thrown out of Garden of Eden, and I work for my living.
Is Aramaic as old as the language of the Bible?
Yeah, the Bible's relatively young. The Bible's the 1300s before the Common Era, so that's 30 years ago. And there's an early language, Akkadian, Babylonian, all that, which goes on. So the language, there's an Ur, an original language from which all these other languages developed. So, yeah, one could see it.
So the Shoresh of Chava would have been recognizable?
To a person in the 13th century, for sure. Yeah. Good. Okay.
Rabbi, Yolim calls her that after the story.
Correct.
She's called Ishana.
A woman.
Well, the
right.
Karmic, so
right.
Just interesting that it's exactly after that he calls. So makes sense.
That's the point. Correct. Good. Let's go on. So now we spoke about Adam and Chava and of course, the name Cain also has a great significance as well. We won't go into that right now. But we want to look now at the father of the Jewish people. Right? Okay, so now we have the father of the Jewish people. His name is?
Avram.
Right? Avram at the very beginning. Okay, good. And he's the only person, with one exception, whose name is changed by God. Right? Now, we have to look at that text for a minute and figure out why exactly is his name changed from Avram to Abraham, and his wife's name is changed from Sarai to Sarah. Sarai to Sarah. Right? Now, what happens? Avram to Abraham adds the letter He, fifth letter of Hebrew alphabet, Aleph, Bet, Gimel, Dalet, He, and Sarai also gets a He. Correct? Good, very nice. His add to Avram becomes Avraham, and Sarai becomes Sarah. So let's look now at the 17th chapter. David, announce the page, please. 17th chapter.
Page 29.
Okay.
Actually, it starts on 28.
Okay. So now you look at verse 5. Is it interesting that verse 5 is in Hebrew, Pasuk Her? And in that Pasuk, what happens? Abraham gets a Her. Accident?
Yes.
Perhaps? For sure? Is that the 26th verse of Sanam Elohim, Yud Kev Vav Kev? Accident? Okay. Skeptic among us. Is that okay?
He gave it his own words back.
I think so. Yes.
Sort of.
Okay, good. V'loy kare od. So God says now at this point, I want you to be av hamon goyim. I want you, Abraham, this goes back now about 4,000 years. So 3,800 years ago, Abraham lived, and he finds his pathway to the Almighty, to God. And over here, in this context, God says, I have now chosen you. You're a good man. I want you to become not only the father of my chosen nation, I want you, Abraham, as well to be the father of multiple nations, which of course actually happened. Islam is a direct descendant of Judaism, as is Christianity. Originally, Christianity came from Judaism, as did Islam have a relationship with Judaism in the 6th century after the Common Era, 7th century. And this actually comes to bear. What's interesting about that is that there are 1.2 billion Muslims, 1.8 billion Christians, 14 million Jews, and that means that 3 billion of the 6 billion people in the world today were affected by Abraham. Astounding. So this really actually happened, right? They all see Abraham as their progenitor. Very nice. And in verse 5, God says, I'm not going to call your name Abraham any longer, rather Abraham. Ki av hamon goyim, I made you the father of multiple nations. Good. So now let's ask this question. God wants to establish a covenant or a berit, an agreement with this man, Abraham. And he says to him, I want to change your name in order to solidify, to concretize this change. This change in status. Abraham was before that only the father of the Jewish nation, let's say. All of a sudden now he's going to become the father of many, many nations. So if that's the case, God says, I have to change your name with your change in status. So this name change is symbolic in a change in destiny. Abraham was going to go on one route, and now all of a sudden God says, I want you to go on a different pathway to become an Abraham, the father of many nations. So now, why do this? Why must there be a name change to accompany a change in status? Is it psychology or theology? What does that mean? What would mean it's psychology? How would that make a difference?
Because he's telling him that he's going to change his life for the future.
Right? Okay, good. So, yeah, so God saying to him, I want you to change your psychological awareness of who you are. And let's say you have a child who, let's say, is wayward. Right? Now, imagine if you, the parent, says to the child, look, you had a history of who knows what, and at a certain point, I want you to become a better person. That's an abstraction. What do you mean by better person? But imagine now changing his name from what it was to symbolize a new person. So now this person becomes a new person because of the name change. A different self-perception. That might work. It may not work. But it might give that child the impetus to break the bonds of who he was, trapped by whatever he was trapped by, his demons of drugs and alcohol and whatever else it might have been, that now I'm a new person. Now I can have a new self-perception. Even, interestingly enough, when somebody's very ill, what do we do? Now, is that theological or psychological?
Theological.
Or both?
Both.
Well, I would say to you that God knows that person, to heal that person, whatever the name is. If God wants to heal, then God doesn't need the name change. But maybe we want that person to now perceive himself to be different. Because illness is half psychological. Half, maybe three quarters psychological. There's a great book to read about illness by Norman Cousins called The Anatomy of Illness, where he was, in 1961, he was dead and dying. And every single doctor says, you're dead and dying. That's it, your history. Whatever kind of disease he had. And he says, well, look, could I self-medicate? Do you mind? Doctor says, no, 61, 62. He was the editor of Life magazine and all kinds of other literary efforts he made. So he said, I want massive amounts of vitamin C, and I want to watch countless movies of the Marx Brothers. Vitamin C is immune system, right? And laughter, making me feel good about myself, is going to heal me. And he lived 33 more years. It's a great book. I have it in my house. Anatomy of an Illness. It's a great book. To laugh is so healthy. Therapeutic, just to laugh. Means you, not always, obviously. Can I have a good laugh from everybody over here? That wasn't all right. So, that I would say is psychological. That's psychological. So maybe the name changed, you want to change destiny? I want you to feel differently about yourself, perhaps. And maybe it's also theological, in some sense or other. Yeah, one?
I've heard of one that's been done with an infant that's been very sick, and they changed the name, thinking that, but so that...
Then it would be theological.
Yes, if the baby's not...
Aware.
Aware.
Or the parents, the family, right. Look at the child differently. Yeah.
But they also say so that the Malach HaMavit can't find him, no?
Do you think he's that stupid?
I don't know.
Yes, they do. They want to justify what they do, but obviously... obviously it's not literally true. It's mainly meant, I would say, to change the psychology, and if there's a theological element to it, it's not readily evident. Because God knows the person who wants to hear is going to hear, whatever your name is. We believe. All right, any case, let's go on. So perhaps over here, God is now changing Abraham's name from Abram to Abraham because he wants Abraham to now think of himself differently. Abraham now has a changed mission in life.
Why didn't he change Moses' name when he was so hard to convince him that he was going to carry out his
work? Good question. Very good question. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not in Bereshit. That's in Shemot. That's in another class. Let's just stay over here in Genesis. It's hard enough. Okay, good.
Okay.
Interesting. Can anybody think of a contemporary example of somebody of great stature who, once he achieves the stature, changes his name? Who? Who's Prince?
The artist formerly known as Rod.
As who? Prince?
Yeah.
He used to be Prince.
Now what is he?
Changed his
name. Then he was a symbol.
Then he changed his name to a symbol.
His own name.
Right.
History.
So he was called the artist formerly known as Prince.
Do you listen to this stuff? No, it's not.
Fiction. He makes conversation.
The 8 o'clock five. You do? Just keep it with 60 years ago. Okay, David.
Cassius Clay changed his name.
That was
because he changed his religion.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah, major. He changed his whole life.
Okay. I was thinking of the Pope. The Pope changes his name when he becomes the Pope. Pope John Paul, before that, was not John Paul II, he was some Kyle or whatever his name was, and now the new Pope also changed his name to St. Benedict the 16th, I think it is, or whatever it was. Why? Because that's their model. That a change in status. The church wants you to see yourself differently and wants others to see you differently as well. So it's an obvious point. Good. To see yourself differently, psychologically, and have others relate to you differently with a new name. So we understand why Abraham and Abraham was a change in personality, different mission, and now you have to see yourself differently. Now, Yitzhak, Isaac, is a very interesting person. He's the only one of the forefathers where there's no name change. Abraham changed. And of course, Jacob changed to Israel. Down the road, we'll get to that. Right? Is there any significance to the name Isaac? The name in Hebrew means to laugh. So Isaac is the future tense. Will laugh. So imagine calling a child, he will laugh. Or laughter. Okay? Let's look at and try to figure out, is there in fact any significance to the name Laughter, who is the name of the second of the three forefathers of the Jewish people? Abraham is one, Jacob is three, Isaac, or Laughter, is the second name. Let's look at the beginning. We look at chapter 15, verse 2, to begin this. Now what's interesting over here? In chapter 15, verse 2, David, page please.
25.
Good. At that point, Abraham is questioning. He says, Almighty God, you said to me you're going to give me a great reward. What reward can you give me? I have no child. At that point in time, Abraham had no children. So give me great wealth. If I don't give it to my children, what good is it? So old people need to give their wealth to their children. Got it? Everybody? You ready? Okay, that's it. So Abraham says in verse 3, you didn't give me a son. Who's going to inherit me? My domestic help. So then God says in verse 4, no. This domestic help will not inherit you, but rather he who comes from your loins, from your biology, he'll inherit you. And then God takes Abraham outside. Now he's an older man already, 75, 80 years old. Look at the heavens. Count the stars. Can you count them? No. So it says your children will be as plentiful as the stars. So in verse 6 we're told, Abraham believed in God's promise. Okay, very good. Now we look at chapter 16, and over here, Sarah is very upset. She also wants to have a child. She cannot do so. So what should she do? She takes a maidservant, whose name is Hagar, mm-hmm. Right?
Shemaya.
And interesting, of course, the name Hagar also has an interesting name. Ha is the, and God sounds like Ger. Ger means stranger. Biblically means stranger. Right? Hagar, Hager. Perhaps. Okay, don't worry about that. So Sarai says, look, Abraham, I want you to come and have relations with my maidservant. So at least you will have a son, and Ulai Ibn, and I will build my house by adopting this child. Okay, Abraham says, okay, he has a relationship with her, and right away Hagar, who's an Egyptian woman, conceives, and then she becomes arrogant, because now that I have a son, I'm the woman of the house now. Who are you, Sarah? You have no children. My son is going to inherit all this wealth. So, she becomes arrogant, and Sarai becomes very upset about this. And she yells at Abraham, how dare you let the situation happen? Let God judge between you and me. And Abraham says, do whatever you want with her. So Sarai then afflicts her, and Hagar runs away, and eventually she meets an angel, and an angel tells her, you will have a child, his name is Ishmael. Call him Ishmael, which means God has heard your prayer, and he'll be a great nation. Okay, that happens. Now, we go a little bit further, to chapter 17, which we had seen already, where over here, Abraham's name is changed to Abraham. Very nice. Okay, it's good. We had seen that. Now you look on chapter 17, and God tells Abraham over here, I want you to have a covenant, berit, of circumcision. Now, what does the word millah mean in Arabic? Millah in Arabic means community. So it's the covenant of community. Berit Milah is a covenant of community. Milah is an aggregate of people, a nation. So it's the covenant of nationhood. That's Berit Milah. Very good. Now, Abraham, okay, he has a son, Ishmael. So Sarah's not his mother. Okay, big deal. But God says something very surprising. That's in verse 15, which page, David?
29.
Okay. Elohim says to Abraham, Sarai, your wife, don't call her name Sarai, call her Sarah, Sarah with that hair. I'm going to bless her, and I'm going to give this woman, Sarah, a son. I will bless that son, and she will be a great nation too, and kings shall emerge from her. Now, at this point in time, Sarah is about 90 years old. Can't be. Sarah's 89. You'll see. So Abraham falls on his face in disbelief, and he laughs. He laughs. God promised him, didn't really happen. Now Abraham laughs. By Yitzhak, he laughs. He says in his heart, I'm 100 years old, I can't have a son any longer. And Sarah, she's 90, she can have a child. Women 90 cannot have children. Her time for their children has passed. It's biologically impossible at this point for her to have a child. It's called menopause. Can't have a child. Okay, so Abraham laughs. And Abraham says to God, listen, God, can't happen. So Abraham says to God, Halvai, it should only be that Ishmael shall be your chosen one. I have Ishmael, he's 13 years old. Let him be your chosen one. So, but God says, no, Aval, but I'm telling you, Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. And I want you to call him Yitzhak because you laughed. Interesting. Okay, so here we see that because he laughed, you're going to call your son laughter. Good. And again, we see after this the promise of a child. Good.
Robert,
yeah.
What is Hashem promise plural for Sarah?
I'm sorry, what? I didn't hear.
Hashem promise.
Which verse?
Sarah. Yes, Abraham about Sarah that she's going to have a child and she will be the matriarch of nations, plural. And
she will be.
Where's the nation?
Well, you'll see later on. Esav becomes Edom. You'll see later on. They all become. Esav will become. Okay, good. Let's go on. Getting a little bit late. So now, Abraham, over here at 17, is a bit skeptical. Laugh, how could it be? God responds, and he says, let Ishmael be the person chosen. God says, no, but Sarah will have a son and call him laughter. Okay? So now, Abraham's going to call his child laughter. He's the only one of the forefathers who was named by God. God names Isaac laughter. Not Abraham, as Ishmael. Now look at chapter 18 and look and see Sarah in verse 19, in verse 9, right? What happens over here? Messengers come to Abraham and they say, where's Sarah? She's behind. She's in the kitchen, she's cooking. So where's Sarah? She's behind in the tent. So this message says, 9 months from now, Sarah's going to have a son. Sarah hears, the tents are together, right over here. She hears, and verse 11 tells me, they're old people. Sarah no longer has the way of woman. What does that mean? Get children. Menopause, right. So what does Sarah do in verse 12? She laughs. But Sarah said that because she laughs internally. She says, after now that I'm withered, I'm now going to have my Eden. Eden means time or my period. Could that happen right now to me? Impossible. And the word Eden also is a reflection on Gan Eden, which means the pleasure of a sexual intimacy. This can't happen at this point any longer. And my husband is very old. He can't do it either. So now, in verse 13, what does God say to Abraham? Why is Sarah laughing? Why is she laughing? And why did she say, can I have a child? I'm too old. Is anything impossible for God? 9 months from now, she will have a son. Now, in verse, interesting, 15, Sarah denies laughing. I didn't laugh. She was afraid. She laughed skeptically. And when God says, why is she laughing? Not believing in my great powers? God says, she says, I didn't laugh. And then God says, no, you really laughed. Look at how many times the word laughter appears in this context. Here and above with Abraham. Good. Sorry?
We're not done yet.
Correct. Good. So now, Sarai denies it. She laughs again. And God says, it's going to happen.
Why is Sarai reprimanded and Abraham is not still laughing?
We'll come back.
Or is she broken?
No, we'll come back to that. Now look at chapter 21. Finally in chapter 21 on page... page 37. Here's the birth of Isaac. God chose, took note of Sarah, as he said, and God did to Sarah what he promised her. She became pregnant, and she had a son as an older woman, Liz Kunav. Good. 9 months after God promised it. Now, Abraham calls in verse 3 the name of his son, Yitzhak. Because God told him to, you have to call this child laughter because you all laughed. Right? Abraham gives him b'nei milah, of course, as God commanded him. Abraham's 100 years old when Isaac laughter is, in fact, born. Now look at verse 6. Sarah says, Sehok asali Elohim. God has brought me. Now, what does the word Sehok mean in that context?
Joke.
Either you made me into a laughing stock, I'm an old withered woman and now I'm nursing a child, or, as the commentaries say different things, the Aramaic says, God's brought me joy. That she says, God's brought me joy. Rashbam, another commentary says, you brought me the happiness of amazement. Because all of a sudden, I have a child. So it's Simchas Timahon. But this word over here probably means both. And the word appears twice in that verse 6. So, Chokasai Elohim, God brought me joy. Whoever hears this will laugh at me or with me or both. What do you think? Can have both of them.
Yeah, it can be. She could be happy, people could laugh at her.
Right. Mockingly.
Right.
You're an old woman. Imagine seeing a 90-year-old woman nursing a child with a baby carriage. It's not nice. What's going on with you people, Abraham and Sarah? And some will probably be joyful. Good. So here we have the word laughter again. That Sarah, the boy is born. Isaac is born. Laughter is born. She calls him laughter. It's hot. And she says, God made me joyous, happy. I was mocking above. Did I mock before? Some people are going to mock her. So you have a lot of interplays of things going on over here. Good. Now, we have this term Sehok appearing so many times in this context to raise the question, why is this name of our second patriarch, don't use the word Isaac, it means laughter. Why are we calling the second patriarch of our nation laughter? Right? Why? And question, is that the end of the laughter story? No, we have one more story about laughter. Right? We see in verse 9, Sarah the mother sees that son of Hagar, that convert, that Egyptian woman, that who gave birth to Abraham, he, Ishmael, was playing with Isaac. Now, what does playing mean? You think they were playing marbles?
No.
Monopoly? Risk? Ping pong? What does playing mean that aroused in her this great indignation, anger, says, get out of my house?
It was toying.
Toying? Maybe deriding him?
Right.
Okay, good. That Isaac could say, you think you're getting all the pieces of the pie? I'm 13. I'm older. I'm 13 years your senior. I'm older than you. You're getting nothing. I'm getting it all. So maybe that was sibling rivalry. The commentary that she says, to understand this, I want you to tell us, do what I call a trans-biblical search. And find that word, sehok or laughter, in other contexts. See what the implications are. So it gives us three other contexts. In one context of the sin of the golden calf, we have kumu lesahek. They're going to play, in that context, means idolatry. So here, it means that Ishmael was teaching him the ways of idolatry. That she says. And in the second context, Misahek, besides that, it means sex. Because we have another verse in Joseph, where the wife of 45 says, my master brought somebody in to play with me, which means sex. Right? So the word Misahek to play with can mean either idolatry or can mean have sexual relationships. Now here would be homosexual relationships. Right? One more time, one more issue. And finally, we have another verse in the book of Melachim, in the book of Shemuel Bet, where the word Misahek to play means to engage in playful
sports.
Where somebody's going to be killed.
A duel.
It's a play. We're going to play. It's going to be a game. A playful game, but we know the two rival generals, that the end is really something more serious, where somebody's going to be killed. So, the word lesachek in this context means all of the above, or perhaps only one of the above, either idolatry, sexual relations, or murder. Right? That's what the word means. So now, of course, Sarai reacts very strongly with this, and throw this woman out of here. And throw her son away as well. Get rid of Ishmael, get rid of Hagar. This man, Ishmael, this son of mine, my stepson, I'm not happy with. Okay, he throws her out. So now we see that laughter played such a role in Isaac Laughter's life. Anybody doubt that? Repeatedly, from Abraham to Sarah, till people laughing at her, people laughing with her, to over here, it's all about laughter. So now, how do we analyze this properly to understand why are we calling the second patriarch laughter? All these people laugh with him, against him, and all that stuff. What does it really mean? So now let's go back to 17:19 and figure out why does God want Abraham to call his son laughter? Right? 17:19. Here's where David's question will come into play. In 17:19, which is on page
29,
verse 19, Elohim says to Abraham, "You just laughed." God says to Abraham, "You just laughed. But I tell you, Sarah, your wife, will have a son and call him laughter." God's response to Abraham's skeptical laughter is insistence. He's insisting. His name is going to be always an answer to those who are skeptical about God choosing the Jewish people. Whenever Abraham calls his son Yitzhak, what's Abraham going to remember? "I was skeptical." As a Jew, this we are going to see, we're going to have a very checkered history. There's going to be high points and low points. They're going to be slaves, they're going to be redeemed from slavery. There's going to be a wonderful, glorious first commonwealth and exile. Second commonwealth and exile. There's going to be 2,000 years of a Christian group saying, "You think you're chosen? Look, you're the dirt of the earth. You have no power, you have no money, no political status. Convert to Christianity. That's the true religion." For 2,000 years, the Christians told the Jews, "Convert, because obviously we have the power, we have the status of everything." What would the Jew respond to that Christian claim? With laughter. Because you think that just because we are 2,000 years in exile means God no longer chose us? Look at our beginnings. Our beginnings began with quote-unquote laughter. And yes, Abraham was skeptical. You're skeptical about our chosen status? The Jew tells the Christian? Well, this verse proves that we can quote-unquote laugh at all of you. So it's emblematic of Isaac's life and our life as Jews. Remember, Isaac is the first biological recipient of the covenant. Because he's Abraham's son, Isaac, and now he's going to inherit biologically, biologically the covenant, which is what this checks in. Now also, what does God say to Sarah when she laughs? Even more strongly, in verse 14 of chapter 18. What is that telling me about? Page 31. What is that? What's the key word in that verse? What does God want Abraham and Sarah to always remember? What's a key verb? Dave, read that verse.
In English?
Wondrous. Do you read English?
Somewhat.
So read it.
"Is anything too wondrous for the Lord? I will return to you at the same season next year, and Sarah shall have a son."
Good. What's the key word?
Wonder.
Exactly. Wonder. God says, Hayit Paleh, it's a half shela, it's a half question. Is anything impossible for the Almighty? It's a rhetorical question. So what does God want Abraham and Sarah to remember every time they call their son laughter? That they laugh, doubting, questioning, skeptical about God's power. And what was the answer? Flesh and blood in front of you, he's here. As a 100-year-old man who is too old to have a child, as a 90-year-old woman who's too old to have a child biologically, here is God's power. So the miracle of Isaac's birth, of Yitzhak, was meant to be a lifelong lesson for the Jewish people.
But was he the first one, this recipient of the covenant? Was he the first one?
Of that covenant, not of covenant in general, because mankind had a covenant with God before.
Because was Ishmael had a verse or not?
Yes.
He did, because
he was one before.
Right, that's what I'm...
He was, yeah, so he had a covenant, a separate one. Different, this is a separate one. This is only a Jewish covenant. Okay, two more points, right? So here we see that even an elderly man and woman can have a miraculous child. So Isaac, therefore, then is the ongoing symbol of A, God's power to override the laws of nature. We call it a miracle. B, to fulfill his promises. What did God promise way back in chapter 16? You're going to have a child, you have multiple children. Believe in my promises. Here's the first step of my promise. So Isaac is a living embodiment of God fulfilling his promise. C, that the covenant is established with Isaac, as chapter 17 proves. Why is it so important? Because, as mentioned, that now we have the transference of this agreement between God and the Jewish people biologically. And here Isaac is not only chosen because he chose. In other words, Abraham chose God. Right? Good. And then God chose Abraham because Abraham chose God. Right? Remember that famous quote. How odd of God to choose the Jews. It's not so odd. The Jews chose God. Right? That was the answer that Maurice Samuels gave to the anti-Semites, who said, you think you're the chosen people? Why would God choose the Jews? It was Arnold Toynbee, the famous English historian, who wrote 19 volumes of a world history, and he called the Jews a fossil people. The Jews have been chosen, they're dead and gone. We're a fossil people. And then Maurice Samuels answered that with this quip, how odd of God chose the Jews? Not so odd, the Jews chose God. So we chose first. So Abraham chose God. Isaac did not choose God. But Isaac is chosen despite the fact that Isaac did not choose. God says now, Jewish people, wake up, listen. You are now chosen. Whether or not you choose, you're in this covenant. We don't choose to be Jews. We are biologically Jews. A convert chooses to be a Jew. So I want to be Jewish. You convert, you're equally Jewish to every other biologically Jewish person. If you choose to be Jewish, we don't choose. We now are chosen with a covenant, even though we didn't choose. Because Isaac didn't choose, but God said it's biologically transferred from Abraham to Isaac. So this becomes emblematic for the Jewish people. We are chosen by virtue of this covenant, even if we do not choose. So Isaac is the first recipient of the biological covenant. He becomes the model for all the Jewish people. And finally, lastly, besides Isaac, symbol of God's power overrunning the laws of nature, B, besides God fulfilling his promise, and C, besides the fact that now Isaac becomes the recipient of this covenant, and D, what happens with the last context of laughter? Isaac has to be separate from Ishmael because of Ishmael's character flaws. He was playing with Isaac. Idolatry, sex, or some kind of murderous intent, whatever it is, we see that now we have to act ethically and morally beyond. The Jew has to stand alone when it comes to issues of character. Isaac and Ishmael at that point are separated. Ishmael goes his merry way, and Isaac has to be raised alone by Abraham and Sarah. So the Jew has to always protect his moral integrity by making sure that that becomes the focal point of Jewish life. The moral, ethical integrity has to be developed within the Jewish context without the influence of Ishmael. So we see that over here, the second patriarch, Isaac's laughter's name, plays a great role in determining who the Jewish people are. The third patriarch, Jacob, will leave to another occasion. Thank you all for coming tonight. Any questions?
Yes. How come God was breaking the covenant when he asked?
That's the fourth question for another session. The answer is the last two verses. Sorry?
Excuse me?
What?
The answer to everything, I guess.
Oh, yeah. You read it very carefully.